Next case is 04574, Miles R. Henderson versus Lawyer Title Insurance Company. Justice O'Donnell has recused himself in this case. And we're very pleased to have sitting in place of Justice O'Donnell, Judge Julie Edwards, who's a judge of Court of Appeals, sitting in the 5th Appellate District. She will appear very soon. Welcome, Judge Edwards. Mr. Collins.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I am Tim Collins, and with Thomas Scanlon and Scott Wilson, I represent Lawyers Title Insurance Corporation, and I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you. There are two issues today before the Court. The first is, I think we can call the contract formation issue, whether the lower courts improperly held that no insurance contract was formed due to the delivery of the title insurance policy after the real estate closing, and due to the lack of express assent by the insureds to the policy terms. The second issue is the Gehrig issue, I would characterize it, whether the lower courts improperly held that a third party seeking benefits under a contract is subject to the burdens imposed by that contract, and we submit that the answer to both of those questions is yes. With regard to the insurance contract formation issue, the error of the lower courts in this case was, in addition to ignoring the intentions of the parties to form an insurance contract, relying upon the dicta in Robinson versus Central Reserve Life, which follows the incorrect application of Ohio contract and insurance law found in Nationwide Insurance versus Marsh. Additionally, the lower courts erred by ignoring the insured's actual possession of the insurance policy for 3 years without objection. Robinson is a Cuyahoga County Court of Appeals decision authored by the recently deceased Judge Ann Kilbane. It involved a pre-printed health insurance policy that included an arbitration provision in its policy form. The Robinson court was reviewing a trial court ruling compelling arbitration under the policy. The Robinson court held, twice in its opinion, that because the policy itself was somehow not included in the appellate record from the trial court, it couldn't review the validity of the arbitration ruling. However, Judge Kilbane continued to speak her mind on her view of the enforceability of the arbitration clause, and that is clearly dicta. Unfortunately, that Robinson dicta became the basis for the decision in this case. Additionally, Robinson's dicta and the case itself relies on the first opinion, the per curiam opinion written by this court in Nationwide Insurance Company versus Marsh. We submit that the first Marsh opinion is wrong and is ripe for reversal under the standards announced by this court in Gladys. The facts of Marsh involved the purchase of an auto policy, an auto accident 7 days later, and the delivery of the insurance policy along with an arbitration endorsement 9 days after the accident. The first Marsh opinion held that the failure of Nationwide to discuss the endorsement with the insured at the time of the purchase of the policy defeats the claim that the endorsement is part of the contract. This holding is incorrect as a matter of Ohio insurance and general contract law and should be overruled. For 112 years, Ohio insurance law has held that a printed insurance policy is evidence of an insurance contract, but that the contract may be formed orally. In other words, prior delivery or prior discussion of the terms of an insurance policy, or for that matter, any contract, is not required, and that's been the law since 1893.
Mr. Collins, there seems to be some dispute about whether an arbitration clause in a contract and a title insurance policy such as this is common. Does the record help us on that? Mr. Karp, I think, says that it's not that you say it's common, and so unless there's some extraordinary language in a title contract, the parties purchasing it should accept it even after the closing.
Your Honor, it is unrebutted in the record, and it's in pages 35 and 36, that in 1999, the time frame when these folks clearly ordered a owner's policy of title insurance from Lawyer's Title, the 1992 owner's policy was the usual and customary policy issued. It was, at that time, the most current owner's policy, and the usual and customary issued at that time would have been the 1992 policy, and they're all 1992 owner's policies of title insurance include an arbitration provision. In fact, these policies are written by a national organization, the American Land Title Association. Then they are reviewed and approved by the Ohio Department of Insurance. The lawyer's title does not just issue policies of their own accord without appropriate review by the Department of Insurance. So indeed, at that time, this was a customary term.
Counsel, what happened here, a bit, my understanding is that there was a title policy ordered, which is standard and customary for a land transaction, correct?
Right.
It was produced, and that was all done prior to, I guess, the closing and the purchase of these homes, right?
Correct.
And then
the policy wasn't produced. There was an order placed by a title, by a real estate agent on behalf of the as both buyer and seller. Their same real estate agent in both transactions requested an owner's policy. Shortly thereafter, a commitment letter was issued. And the commitment letter identified the specific policy that was going to be used, the 1992
right. Okay.
owner's policy.
Let me ask you, at that point in time, isn't it pretty much a standard procedure that you get the policy, it's there, the contents of the policy are really not negotiated between the purchaser here and the provider of the insurance policy?
Ordinarily, that is correct. In some instances, if a party wants to negotiate, the more frequent method of negotiation isn't to do much to the policy language of the 1992 policy, but it's to ask, for instance, for the 1970 policy. And that also was the unrebutted testimony of Mr. Endress, representative of Lawyers Title, at the evidentiary hearing in this matter. So if someone wanted a different policy because they want different kinds of coverage or to get rid of certain kinds of coverage, for instance, an arbitration provision, that can be done by requesting one of the other policies that were live and available at that time, which had been approved by the Department of Insurance.
So what you're saying then is that there was a variety of policies that could have been used at the time. Some had arbitration clauses, some did not.
Correct.
All right, so then what you just said about, you know, all the policies from 1992 contained arbitration, but not all policies that were on the market at the time contained an arbitration
clause.
That's
true, but the usual and customary one would have been the current one at the time. And in 1999, the most current owner's policy of title insurance was the 1992 policy. That policy form, there was only one of them, and it had arbitration in it as one of 17 terms and conditions.
And does the record reflect that that policy, the 1992 policy, was the policy that was overwhelmingly used in the industry at the time?
The record does not reflect it, but the testimony is that was the, when someone placed a plain vanilla request to Lawyers Title in 1999 for an owner's policy of title insurance, that was the one that was issued. There is no other evidence in this case.
Counsel, isn't the, I'm assuming what happened here, and you tell me where I'm wrong. As you get to a closing, the people lending the money require title insurance.
Or that's true.
In some locales, they'll accept an attorney's certificate, but in most financial institutions today, say, it's got to be title insurance. So the agent of somebody, buyer or seller, here arranges, or the closing agent arranges all of this stuff, and the buyer and the seller really don't get consulted at all. It's just one of the things that's there, and what they get consulted about is the fee that's charged. That's on the closing statement. That's about all the knowledge they have concerning the policy of title insurance. Would that be a fair statement?
I would say in most instances that is true. Not in all. Depends upon if a skilled counsel is brought to bear.
They don't know what company. They don't know who's getting a commission for furnishing this or anything else. It's just it's down there, and it's based on the price of the transaction. This is the fee.
That's correct.
And there. You say there were policies available at the time that whoever put this together, presumably not the buyer or the seller, could have selected one that didn't have an arbitration clause?
Yes, I think the testimony in the hearing was that there were five policies of title insurance, owner's policies, available at the time. There are, of course, other, as you indicate, forms of title guarantee, yeah, which supply the same kind of security. But in terms of owner's policies of title insurance, there were five available at the time with varying terms.
And you assert that it's in the record that there was a, it was possible to bargain for one that didn't have an arbitration clause?
Yes, and you will hear Appley's counsel probably identify the pages of the record where that testimony was solicited. In a conclusory fashion, though, the lawyer's title witness indicated, as I've already said, but the 92 policy was the one issued in 1999.
The underlying rub here is these folks claim that they should have been able to get a better rate based on a re-upping of this policy. Is that?
That is the merits of the case. That's correct. We are on an arbitration issue.
And arbitration does not prohibit them from succeeding on the merits of that claim, does it?
No, it doesn't. They can present the merits of their claim, we think, in the form of alternative dispute resolution in arbitration.
Does it make somehow more difficult a class action to do that?
All of those are issues, Your Honor, that we have not yet explored. I think, again, you will probably hear Appley's counsel say that that is what they view this whole exercise is about. Rather, we view it as we have a contractual arrangement, how to resolve our disputes. We'd like to abide by it. We entered into it. We got it approved by the Department of Insurance. We'd like to abide by this mechanism.
Okay, but there's a real world out there. So, what's your take on whether or not it makes that becomes a bar to class action?
We don't think there is much in the way of case law on that, so perhaps we'd be revisiting this court with that discussion because it's a very real and very serious issue. We have not gotten to it. We've not briefed it. It's been raised as the interim argument why we should not be allowed to go forward with arbitration. That's true, but we haven't done any of the legal research or filed any motions with respect to that. I think there is not much law in Ohio on it.
We decide discrete legal issues, and you have a discrete legal issue here, but I, for one, don't like to decide those not knowing that there's a whole other set of ramifications that are important.
Well, Your Honor,
when you decide that discrete legal issue.
Understood, but the discrete legal issue is whether or not we have to, according to the Court of Appeals, produce a policy or have a prior discussion before a binding contract is in place. That's a huge issue. In fact, the ramifications of proceeding under the Henderson opinion, we think, would rock the foundation of the insurance world, of the commercial contracting world, and the Uniform Commercial Code with its gap fillers all gets pushed aside by
this
kind of
opinion.
There's
a term called binder that's used in the insurance world. Is that really what happens at the closing here, is that there's a binder for title insurance, that is the purchaser and the purchaser's lending institution knows if there's on the bill at the closing statement title insurance for a specific title company, that if defects in the title occur, even though the policy hasn't been produced, that those are going to be covered by the policy, period.
Yes, the phrase in the title insurance world is a commitment to insure as opposed to binder. I think in the Nationwide versus Marsh case in the dissent, the phrase binder, and of course in the auto insurance property and casualty world, we're used to talking about binders.
So the term of art would be commitment.
Yes, commitment to insure. That's the letter that's issued.
Counsel, part of the reason you don't issue the final policy, is that not that you have to actually wait till the sale is completed and then you have to have the title registered or recorded before you can actually say that this policy is insured? How does that process work?
Yes, and indeed, it is another element is that the mortgage has to be satisfied. And if you recall in your case of the In Re Consolidated Mortgages case, 5301.36B gives mortgage holders 90 days after being paid to file their satisfaction of mortgage. That has to happen before the owner's policy can issue. So the legislature's already spoken to the fact that this is going to drag out a little longer than your ordinary insurance transaction. so that the satisfaction can be filed of record with regard to the underlying mortgage. And the policy can't be issued until that's satisfied, among other things.
Well, but why not? I mean, why can't the, how disruptive would it be for the parties to have a copy of the form contract? If you don't want, I obviously can't bind it until the closing, but I guess I don't quite understand why. In fact, I try never to bring my own experiences into these cases, but I actually had a title policy before a closing once. And certainly it's not effective unless there's a closing, but I guess I don't quite understand why the parties, at least the person who's paying for the policy, could not have a form policy. This is the title policy. It's going to be effective when at the closing, and then the person could have the opportunity to read if there's an arbitration clause, whatever they don't like. How disruptive would that be?
In the first instance, it's available. It's available in the public record. It's available on the internet. It's available by request.
Well, but I don't. The internet. That's below. I mean, I'm sorry. Sure, you can go to the internet. You can go down to the courthouse. You can go to the title office and say, "Give me a copy of your." This is, you know, we're talking about practicalities, and saying that you can't. You know, you can't have a policy until the closing. Well, people have contracts before they execute them. I mean, they read them before they execute them. Why is this different?
In the same way, Your Honor, they also have contracts before they receive the documents. And I don't think in the insurance industry, as a consumer, if you think back, maybe perhaps you had an experience with a title policy, think about the last time you bought a car in a Ford dealership, you picked up the phone and said, "I'd like to have my Ford covered." You didn't have the policy.
But
you
that's,
got the coverage.
We know from the brief, I mean, that's a different situation because you've got liability. I mean, that's a different situation. To me, at least, it's a different situation. You have to have a binder immediately when you buy a car or whatever it is. You've got to have coverage. But here, there's not that urgency, is there? You have a closing date set 2 weeks from now, and these contracts, they're all forms. There's not a difference in the contract that they're going to receive, so you send the parties a copy of the contract. Here's, yeah, read it. You don't like it? No house, maybe, or no mortgage.
Well, we think it would be a disturbance of how the insurance industry has dealt with the process of doing the closings, and also in general insurance law.
My question is,
it
how
would
disruptive
change.
Would that be? We all have to deal with change. How disruptive would it be for that to be the practice?
It may lead folks to have the wrong idea, and if indeed they decide they don't want to have coverage with a particular company and go to another one, they're walking around with a document in their hands, and it may create some confusion. I mean, there's enough confusion in this process as it is. If you all of a sudden are thrusting documents into people's hands that they believe give them some form of coverage, and it doesn't because they haven't first paid, and second, the transaction hasn't closed.
You don't think there could be a big statement on it saying this policy not effective until money changes hands at the closing? Is that something insurance companies could figure out how to do?
I would say as a matter of printing on a form that it probably could be done.
Counsel, who orders the title insurance that we're talking about?
Not the consumers. It is almost universally, according to the testimony and in our experience, the real estate agents.
The real estate agent is pretty much shepherding the buyer, the seller, if
That's
they represent
right.
both.
That's right.
And they order and say, "This is all the documents we need for closing, and by the way, your closing is going to be on such and such a date after the title clears, et cetera."
That's right. And there was no interaction in this case, and quite often there is no interaction with the person that Chief Justice Moyer identified as wanting to have a policy. They're not in the mix. There may be 2 to 3 layers of people between the title insurer and the individual who's ultimately purchasing the insurance. And those people in the middle are going to get awful angry if the title insurer leapfrogs over lawyer, real estate agent, bank, escrow agent, and gets to the insured and says, "By the way, here's your policy or your form of policy." There's too many people in between who would take offense to a title insurer wanting to have direct contact with an insured in the midst of that closing of a real estate transaction. I'd like to save whatever time I have remaining for rebuttal.
You have 30 seconds.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Collins. Mr. Karp.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the court. There are two policies that are involved in this case, or two essentially claims. One is the claim that arises out of the so-called sale transaction, wherein our client, the Hendersons, paid one half of the premium. And they never received a policy, they never received a contract, never received anything. The policy went to the purchasers, and that's where it goes. So there was no contractual relationship with one half of the claim. Now, with respect to the other half of the claim, the so-called purchase transaction, yes, we got a policy, no question about it. Yes, it contained an arbitration clause, but we never read it. And they say, you have a duty to read it. The point is that the amicus curiae brought into this case by lawyers' title, two of them say nobody reads a title policy. And the reason is self-evident. It doesn't arrive until weeks, they now tell us months after the transaction is closed. There's one premium, it's always been paid. There's never another premium. There's never another renewal. The policy remains in effect until as long as you have the property. And moreover, what any event that may trigger the policy has already occurred. A flaw in the title, a lien, it's already there. When the transaction closes, it's over.
The trial court or the appellate court seemed to say that because there was no contract provided ahead of time, there was no meetings of mind, and therefore there's no contract at all, correct?
Trial judge said that is correct.
So does that mean that all of these title policies that are floating out here, if we accept that proposition, have no coverage because those contracts are void?
No, I think that the language was rather loose by the Common Pleas Court in that regard. We're not saying that at all. We're simply saying this court held 20 years ago in Nationwide against Marsh said you've got an arbitration clause and an insurance policy.
So you want the benefits of the coverage, but none of the obligations to get the coverage.
Well, the problem is that arbitration is a unique element in insurance. The average consumer doesn't expect that. You buy a policy, you buy a liability policy, you buy a property policy, so you expect there are certain exclusions.
What's your answer to my question? Is it you get the benefits but not the burden if we accept this court's position?
Say that again, Judge Strand.
You get the benefits of coverage even though the court's declared the contract void. You still would get the benefits of coverage but not have the burden of arbitration.
We're not saying the contract is void. We're simply saying you must have a meeting of the minds on arbitration.
So do we have to overturn the Court of Appeals decision because they said the contract is void?
No, they did. They said loose language, if you read it rather closely in the Court of Appeals opinion, they're talking only about the arbitration clause. And that's all this court talked about in Nationwide against Marsh.
Counsel, how could the rest of the contract be valid if there was no meeting of the minds to begin with?
But there is a meeting of the minds. You expect certain terms and certain provisions in a
Well, what about
contract?
The sophisticated purchaser that knows about arbitration clauses in the real world of real estate and coverage and insurance, et cetera, and yet doesn't receive the policy in their hands and doesn't discuss it, orders a vanilla policy, gets a vanilla policy? Do we have to look to the experience of every purchaser to determine whether they're sophisticated enough to know what should be contained in a title policy?
You have to do that because if the issue is there was no meeting of the minds,
you would have to do that. You're saying you'd have to do that.
You may very well have to do that. If the particular purchaser, there's no meeting of the minds, and that purchaser is, for example, a mortgage company, the title company is saying, what are you talking about? You see these every day. You know exactly what the provision is. The Hendersons knew about as much about the onus policy as they knew about the Koran.
So you're saying that there is a title policy for the purposes of protecting their property from a past event, a title flaw, but there is no policy in effect to compel arbitration for this dispute over the price paid.
Precisely. Unless there was a meeting of the minds on the issue, and there was never any meetings of the minds on the issue. They had nothing to do with getting out with this policy. You asked a question to the appellate's counsel woman, who orders these things? The amicus curiae brief says it is normally ordered by the seller. The seller orders the title perk and the title policy. That's what they say. We didn't order it. And in this particular instance, the title policy was ordered by Third Federal, which was the mortgagee. They got it, and they got the information. We never saw it at all. They said, oh, you chose the number. They didn't choose the number at all. And moreover, the Chief Justice asked a question very early on, are these the normal provisions? And the record shows, in its supplement section, pages 141, 142, when the lawyer's title, vice president, was asked, is it a testimony that arbitration clauses are standard, usual terms of title insurance policies? He says, well, I'm aware they're in some policies and they're not in other policies. Question, so lawyer's title uses its 1992 forms as well as the 1970 forms if it wants to, and there's no arbitration clause in it? That's correct. Moreover, even the arbitration clause they use, the so-called 1992 form, doesn't apply to all purchases. Think of it that. If the amount of your insurance policy is $1 million or more, you have no obligation to arbitrate. So it's not a universal provision here at all. The idea is really evilly that
To support your position, do we have to find that an insured is relieved of a duty to read a contract once it comes?
I'm sorry, my hearing problem just
okay. To affirm your position, do we have to find that an insured is relieved of their duty to read a contract once they do receive it?
No, don't have to hold that at all. We're simply saying in the unique situation of title insurance policy, which indeed the Ohio Law Title Association says, it says ask this court to look at the unique aspects of title insurance.
Okay, so you would refine it to say that if it's an insurance, if it's an insurance contract for title insurance, then you don't have to read it.
That is correct, because no one reads it. Everybody admits that.
Well, counsel,
now, what
counsel
comes along
didn't.
Down the pike, how can you avoid this? You can tell them to read it. That was done in the California
counsel,
case.
Didn't the Hendersons have this policy for 3+ years before they
Surely.
Found out about the arbitration
Absolutely.
Clause?
They had it all this time. But as I tried to point out early on, nobody reads these things. It comes in months after the event. It's over. You've got title. You may glance over, I suppose, what liens are on your property.
So because it's a standard practice not to read your title policy as a consumer. There's no fault that lies with the consumer for any of their action or non-action in this contractual relationship. Is that correct?
That's correct.
All right.
All right, now what could be done in this situation? Chief Justice asked a question of counsel appellant. Can't they provide these in advance? They say that it can't. It's chaos, et cetera. We say, easy enough. If you can't do that,
what would make
put
you
it
think?
In the, huh?
What would make you think that somebody at a closing, and I just did one recently, signed 25 different documents, is going to read that document at that point any more than they're going to read it later?
Well, I was just trying to say, Judge Stanton, that I don't go that far. The argument is made, it creates a crime. Very simple to deal with this problem. The title commitment comes out. It's a regular printed form. You can put on that title commitment, read the policy. It's available at our office. They said, oh, it's available at the Department of Insurance. Look at the Wolfschlager
case. We need to put a big disclaimer. You need to read this policy. Do we really need to do that to get people to do what they have a legal obligation
if
to do?
If you want to put the arbitration clause in there, which nobody expects. If you take out a property policy and you think you're going to have a claim against the insurance company, does it ever occur to you that you're going to have to arbitrate? Of course not, because it's not in there. Arbitration is not common in a general body of the insurance law. Here it is in this esoteric, discrete area of insurance, title insurance, and bingo, it's in some of those policies. Nobody expects that. And particularly in this situation where they came along, where they were overcharged, an act that occurred before the policy was ever issued, they say you got to arbitrate that. That's another argument that we have, that we submit that this particular claim is not within the scope of the arbitration clause. But be that as it may, who would ever think of that?
Counsel, now, it doesn't directly bear on the legal question that we're asked to respond to. Today. But what's the harm to your clients if they have to arbitrate instead of file a lawsuit?
Because we would have to arbitrate, according to them, every single one of these. They made that very clear, that the whole motive of going this way is to prevent the class suit of this particular issue. They said that in their briefs in the Court of Appeals, and they intimated here in their brief that you cannot arbitrate a class action. So every one of these claims, what was the amount that was paid? 50 bucks, 60 bucks? You have to go into arbitration, which costs more than that.
Is there a definitive answer to that question, or is there a definitive answer to that question, or is he right that that's a yet to be, that's their position, but that no court has really weighed in on it?
It's inaccurate that no court has weighed in on it, because what we pointed out in the Court of Appeals, that the Supreme Court of the United States says you can arbitrate, arbitration is available for a class action unless the arbitration clause specifically says it isn't. They question that in their brief.
So then there might not be a real harm to your client.
That's quite possible. It's quite possible. But that's a bridge that we have to cross along the way. At the moment, we simply say,
it's a bridge you don't want to cross.
That's correct. And so we say, arbitration doesn't apply here. Could I just deal with a moment with respect to the preemption issue? Because they stressed this in their brief, and it really hadn't come up that hard before. They say that because the United States Supreme Court, in the Doctors Against Caruso case, said that the Federal Arbitration Act preempts any state law that impinges or limits arbitration. And therefore, this court's decision Nationwide against Marsh 20 years ago has now been preempted. I should point out to the court that that argument is dead wrong because it ignores the McCarran-Ferguson Act. As this court will recall, American is aware, McCarran-Ferguson Act, which was enacted in the early 1940s, specifically stated that no law of the United States should be interpreted as limiting or constraining any state law involving the business of insurance. What has happened is that does this particular rule involve the business of insurance? There have been a series of decisions of the United States Courts of Appeals that have specifically held that the Federal Arbitration Act does not preempt the state laws regulating arbitration in the context of insurance policies. And I will just kick these off, Mr. Chief Justice, with your permission. The most recent is 358 F3rd 854, which not only involved the title insurance company, not only involved the title insurance policy, it involved this particular arbitration clause. And in that case, the state of Georgia had a statute that said arbitration doesn't apply to insurance. And the argument made by the title insurance company was that arbitration was required under their policy because the FAA had preempted this. And the 11th Circuit, which isn't just last year, said no, the McCarran-Ferguson Act essentially reverse preempts it. It blocks the preemption. And there are three other U.S. Courts of Appeals decisions that have held exactly the same way, that McCarran-Ferguson blocks any limitation by any preemption of arbitration. They are 267 F3rd 821, which is the 8th Circuit, 66 F3rd 41, which is the 2nd Circuit, and 969 F2nd 931. One final point is that with respect to the scope, we submit that even if it somehow be concluded that arbitration was binding on these particular parties, even the contract, and even in a transaction in which my clients received no contract at all, this particular claims fall outside of the scope of the arbitration clause. First of all, the arbitration clause says it has to be a dispute between lawyer's title and the insured. We were not insured under one of these transactions. And secondly, it has to relate to the policy itself. And we submit our claim doesn't really relate to the policy. It relates to acts committed by lawyer's title before the policies were issued. They overcharged us for premium. So for all of these reasons, we would urge this court to affirm the result reached by the courts below. I thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Karp. Mr. Collins, you've used your time, but you may take 30 seconds.
Thank you. The lower courts ignored the intent of the parties. There was clearly a request for an owner's policy. There's no other evidence in the case but that. And an owner's policy was provided, which was the usual and customary term. The lower courts did not seek to bring to bear the intent of the parties. They sought to tear down the intent of the parties and toss out the entire contract.
Counsel, I'm interested in sort of his last comment, and that is that or isn't that in this case? And that is for sellers who pay up at the closing for these policies, and the policy is issued to the buyer, is it not?
That's correct.
How does the arbitration clause cover the seller at all? If their complaint or if their cause of action is, you charged me too much, I should have gotten a better rate because you already had insured this home before, so you already knew the history of the title up until the last few years. If that's the action, how does the arbitration clause in the policy ever reach that person in the real estate transaction?
Because if anyone is entitled to the reissue rate contained in the rate rule, it is a new purchaser. The new purchaser is an insured. The other party that sold the home isn't part of the insurance relationship. The discounted premium arises out of the insurance relationship, not out of the past ownership or even the past insurance relationship. And so squarely, Gehrig applies, the unanimous opinion of this court that said when a third party, in that opinion you talked about signatories, we think signatories can be taken out of this discussion, but other than that, the holding in Gehrig squarely applies because they're trying to derive rights and benefits through someone else's contractual relationship.
Is there another way you could look at that, in that there really was no direct relationship between the title company and the seller? The title company's policy goes to the owner. There was just part of the purchase price of the whole deal. They split the fee, and that's a separate contract between the parties. It has nothing to do with the title company. It just the two parties deciding to split a fee.
Yes, that's the merits. And in the end, they could have given them windows, they could have paved their driveway, they could have bought them a membership to a golf club, or they could have helped them pay for their owner's policy of title insurance. It's all the economic arrangement. The economic arrangement between buyer-seller doesn't give rise to a reduced premium. It's the insurance relationship. When a third party wants to step into that relationship, they have to be subject to the terms of the relationship, arbitration. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Collins. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.